This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Hear about the impact of a law that's supposed to reduce race-based disparities in student discipline in Illinois schools. Not all that successfully.
A lot of black students were suspended for minor offenses, but for longer periods of time.
Illinois State University professor Charles Bell says his research shows that differences in discipline make absenteeism, dropout rates, and educational attainment less for blacks than whites. Plus, late summer is not too late to have your garden bloom. Patrick Murphy and Mike McCurdy tell you how in WGLT's gardening podcast, Grow. Mary Cullen chats with new Economic Development Council CEO Patrick Hoban. And we have a report on books and barbers in West Bloomington. All that and a GLT News update on the way. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from GLT listeners. Join the community of news consumers who listen to Sound Ideas and are also willing to support it financially. Learn more about listener-supported radio and GLT at WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. School discipline systems are driving minority students away from school. That's a conclusion of research done by ISU professor Charles Bell. There's a lot of research showing differences in discipline based on race. For instance, ProPublica found last year that white students in Unit 5 in District 87 are 3.6 more times likely to be enrolled in advanced placement courses than African American students. ProPublica also notes that black students are 4.6 times more likely to be suspended than white students in Unit 5. In District 87, the suspension rate is 3.5 times more likely if you're African American. For 4 years ago, the state even passed a law trying to even out that difference by having more restorative discipline to reduce suspensions overall. But Bell says there has not been a lot of research on the perceptions and impacts from the differences in discipline. He says there are qualitative differences in suspensions as well.
In many cases, black students are disproportionately suspended for more violent offenses, and even for nonviolent offenses. So in some instances, black students may engage in a status offense, dress code, for example. You come to school, you're out of dress code. A white student may not get suspended for that. Black student gets sent home. They get suspended for that. So those are the kind of disparities that we typically see in school discipline.
And length of suspensions for offenses of a similar nature.
Mm-hmm. So length of suspensions was a really important issue where a lot of black students were suspended for minor offenses, but for longer periods of time. So one good example of this is challenging an educator on an assignment, thinking or articulating that you felt that the assignment was sort of biased in a way or was insensitive to a cultural aspect, and that resulted in a 10-day suspension. When we think about the significance of that, that's 10 school days where that student is out of class, they're off track, and many students stated that they could not compensate for that missed instruction. That instruction was so important for them to stay on task, to feel a sense of belonging and purpose in the school setting, that when they returned after the 10-day suspension, they had a lot of difficulty catching up, and many students stated they never caught up. I can tell you that feelings of belonging in school were significantly impacted by the school suspensions and overall sort of districts. So a lot of students and parents felt that my child was being targeted in this particular school, so they were removing their children from schools and engaging in what I call black educational flight. So continuously moving and relocating different districts here in Illinois, searching for a place where they felt that their child would not be subjected to excessive school discipline.
Is there a correlation from low feelings about school to participation in school?
Yes, there's a lot of research that says that school belonging, feeling that your presence is valued, feeling that your ideas are valued, and that you are an important aspect and respected member of the school culture, definitely has a strong correlation to participation in school, forming positive friendships and relationships with educators, and just having an overall successful schooling experience.
Does the school flight and the
increased absenteeism caused by the difference in, or that also correlates to the difference in school discipline records, have an impact on educational attainment? I mean, for instance, ProPublica found that the achievement gap for African American students in Unit 5 was 2.6 grades. And in District 87, it's 2.7 grades, even though District 87 has a higher African-American share of the student body than Unit 5 does. Mm-hmm.
Yes. So a lot of times when students are suspended for those long periods of time, they come back to school, they are completely disconnected from the environment, and then they get another suspension for either talking in class, relatively minor suspensions, and they accumulate. And what happens is that student is eventually transferred to an alternative school setting where they then have to compete with those students who are in the advanced placement classes and they're in an alternative school that doesn't really have those kind of resources. And that's a huge challenge for many families. How do you compete with that? It's impossible.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. We're talking with Illinois State University Professor Charles Bell about race-based discrepancies in discipline and in educational attainment among students in the state of Illinois. School officials know about this. They don't like it, if they're worth anything. They don't like it. Mm-hmm. How is it that teachers, most of whom are of good faith as well, are still doing this, are still saying, okay, I'm going to this data point is in isolation, you're going to be suspended. This data point is in isolation, you're not being suspended. And you end up with a whole bunch of data points that indicates that there's a huge race-based problem there. Mm-hmm. Why is it happening?
So in Illinois, and I actually conducted a similar study in Michigan, I just found the Illinois terrain just to be very different here. First, Illinois is probably more progressive in school discipline reform, shockingly, than most other places. I would also say that in many instances, this was a building or school-based phenomenon where some schools actually took the reform law really seriously and they were aggressively trying to reduce suspensions, where other schools completely disregarded it. They didn't care. They felt that suspensions were the only way that they could actually remove students who were problematic from the school setting. They also felt that the law had no enforcement. So what are you going to do to me? I'm going to suspend students. There's a law. I'm going to violate this law. There's no enforcement of the law.
This is the law that the state of Illinois passed.
Yes, the Senate Bill 100 law.
Okay. And this restorative discipline law, this progressive discipline law, has it had an impact?
I would say in certain areas it has. There are definitely some schools where upon entering the school and looking at their data, you can definitely tell that there's been a significant decline in school suspensions. But there are some districts and some schools within those districts that they felt, and this is a really interesting phenomenon, where they felt that if they could not suspend the students, it took away their only mechanism for discouraging problematic behavior. And it actually created an environment where teachers felt that they would be threatened. In a sense, where they couldn't suspend a student, so they felt that the students knew they wouldn't get in trouble, and it would embolden the students to continue to engage in this behavior, which is sort of an interesting phenomenon, and it just enabled them to continue.
So it's viewing the students as a problem as an enemy, as an opponent.
Mm-hmm.
So how are you going to teach people if you view them that way?
Exactly. How can you teach children that you are afraid of and you fear and you're, yeah.
Are there commonalities in the districts that have ignored the law, that have not changed the way they approach student discipline?
Oh, definitely more predominantly African-American school districts, poor or impoverished communities, and or working class communities, things of that nature, where it would kind of get swept under the rug and sort of normalized in a sense, where this is just how we do things here.
This may be a fruitless question, but it's an interesting one to ask, and there may not be sufficient data available to answer, but here goes. There's a high correlation between lack of educational attainment and likelihood of discipline and low-income status, regardless of race. Mm-hmm. Are there discrepancies in disciplinary action between whites and African Americans of similar income?
Mm-hmm. That's something I do not have data on specifically in Illinois. However, there were studies conducted previously, and they're probably a little outdated at this point, that shows that in the same socioeconomic status, income area, black students are disproportionately suspending.
Still.
Yeah.
Well, how do you get at that problem?
Mm-hmm. That's a really interesting question, and I think that we have to find the root of the issue, which is, in many districts, it's different. Some it's just, you know, a fear, a sort of fear or a rush to remove certain students, and we have to have some sort of cross-cultural competence training as to why are we afraid of the attire of a student? Where does this social imagery play into our conditioning of students and our response to their behaviors and suspensions and expulsions and things like that?
So what does attire mean? Is that potentially gang clothing?
No, or? For example, the infamous hooded sweatshirt. Some teachers see that and they automatically attribute that to being a thug or being gang-oriented, and it doesn't necessarily have those connotations. It could just be a student who is, it could be a student who's impoverished. It could be a student who's homeless. And that hoodie is not only their coat, their shirt, it could be their pillow at night. And I think those are things that we have to really consider. You know, there are reasons why people wear certain attire, and that doesn't necessarily make them bad people or dangerous people.
Were those districts that have refused to dip their toe in the water on this front at significantly higher risk of student-on-teacher or student-on-adult violence?
I would not say that that's the case. What I would say is that a lot of the teacher fears were sort of unwarranted. A lot of the teacher fears were stemming from environmental situations that resonated or originated outside of the school where teachers felt unsafe. And those perceptions of the students, given their attire, the infamous hooded sweatshirt, carried over to the students in the school. So a good example of this is a teacher who may have gotten carjacked in school or robbed on a school grounds. And that sort of persona, that fear, would translate over to a student who's in class and has a hooded sweatshirt and maybe asks a question, and it's perceived to be a threatening manner, and that student suspended.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Our guest is ISU Professor Charles Bell. We're talking about racial differences in the application of disciplinary codes among Illinois schools. You mentioned cross-cultural education, but are there other ways to get administrators to buy into the new law and to say, we need to implement this as best as possible, and we need to push our faculty to become conversant with how this works?
Mm-hmm. I think that administrators who have not bought in already, we need to have a conversation as to why they have not bought in already. And usually it's from opposition from educators. And I think they're opposing it in their classrooms just because they don't have, they can't think or they don't know another mechanism to regulate their classes. When we think about racial disparities in school suspensions, this isn't something that's been going on for 5 years. This is something that we can trace back all the way, you know, 30, 40 years ago. And it's almost like it's ingrained in teachers where they come into districts and they learn that this is how we handle things. This is a culture that's been established, and it's not going to go away overnight. This is something that we have to really work at, continue to find solutions, and dig deep into why we want to suspend students, despite all the research that we know shows that when we suspend students, they are off task, they have lower educational attainment, and it increases their rate of incarceration or risk of incarceration. Why do we want to suspend?
Among the school districts that have started to see the needle move on this, that have taken to heart and really aggressively tried to implement the restorative parts of the new discipline law, do we know what they're doing right and how they're doing it and how portable that is?
I could speak to that just a little bit. From what I've seen is, first, their understanding of the research in terms of a school suspension increases the risk of incarceration. I think just acknowledging that and accepting that we have to do something different, because our ultimate goal as an educator or as an administrator and as a school is to put students on a positive track. By suspending them, we are sort of undoing that positive track and placing them on a negative track. So acknowledging and owning that suspensions are not the solution but are part of the problem is one key thing that I see in common with all those districts. The willingness to try something different, whether it's something that's evidence-based or something that is coming out of an idea, I think that's something that's really novel or in common. Some districts, when I walked in the door, they said, we're trying this. We don't know if it's going to work, but we're willing to try something. And that's the key. Other districts were completely resistant to the idea of trying anything. They were really steadfast in that we're going to suspend students because we don't have an alternative. We view our student population as dangerous. And if we don't suspend, we could get harmed. So,
do lawmakers need to go back and tweak the law? Do they need to put teeth into it since there, as you pointed out, there is no downside for non-implementation?
That's exactly what I think needs to happen. I think the law needs to be revisited, and that's the purpose of this panel that I'm hosting, is just to put students on a panel along with legislators and allow the students to speak, because you can hear it from a researcher, and I have the research to support it, but hearing it from the students who've been affected by this directly, knowing that the law was passed in 2015, and here in 2019, we're still hearing student accounts that, hey, I was suspended for 10 days for a minor violation. No fight, no physical fights, just a minor disagreement. I think that's a significant issue that needs to be addressed in the law.
What are a couple of the districts who have had some success in changing the culture and changing the way outcomes are happening?
I know Bloomington is working towards some solutions, and they were definitely entertaining the fact that school discipline is a problem, that they own the fact that they had some racial issues and racial disparities in school discipline, and they were willing to try something new. I actually submitted a Freedom of Information Act request and required some of their data, and you can definitely see a downward trend in Bloomington High School and things like other things like that.
How much of a trend?
It was noticeable. I wouldn't say that it was pretty significant, but it was definitely a downward trend.
Illinois State University researcher Charles Bell will present some of his data on race-based differences and how school discipline systems drive African-American students away from education. That'll happen August 30th at 1 p.m. Also, as part of the Opportunity Suspended Forum, you can hear from students and lawmakers who helped draft the 2015 reform law. The panel will be, again, August 30th, 1 p.m. in Schrader Hall. That's room 130. On the campus of Illinois State University. Bell also notes the road to expulsion is much easier in Illinois than in Michigan. Often expulsion happens after 3 suspensions in this state, in Michigan, up to 20. He says, on the other hand, Illinois is trying to enact reform, Michigan mostly not, even though both states passed reform bills the same year.
Support for GLT comes from SEFQ, offering competitive rates for home equity lines of credit. Borrowers get personalized service without the hidden fees or early payoff penalties. Plus, SEFQ even covers closing costs for qualified members. Information at SEFQ.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Still to come, hear the vision of the new CEO of the Economic Development Council in Bloomington Normal. Mary Cullen has that interview coming up on Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. The West Bloomington Revitalization Project has teamed up with local barbershops to launch a program to offer young readers the chance to read a book to a barber and get a discount on their haircuts. Karen Schmidt and Mary Yant spearheaded the Barbers with Books program, working alongside local barbers like Eric Howard. WGLT student reporter Tiffany Jackson speaks with all three about why they're doing it. She started with Schmidt, who runs the West Bloomington Revitalization Project's Book Bike program.
I've got about 9 years of experience with the Book Bike, and I watch children interacting with books all the time. It's exciting to see. And this just layered onto it in such a nice way. It felt like it fit into our vision and mission of the WBRP, and certainly was sympathetic to the work we do with the Book Bike.
So what is the ultimate goal for the program, and how many barbershops do you all intend on joining in?
We don't have a goal number. We're thrilled to have the two barbershops that we have with a cut above and one of a kind. And I think we're right now we're getting our feet wet with that and making sure we understand how we can support what they do.
So, Eric, you are the owner of the One of a Kind Barbershop in downtown Bloomington, and you're also a teacher at Hair Masters Cosmetology School.
Absolutely.
What exactly was it about cutting hair that made you want to start?
I draw real well. So as a small kid, I've been doing this since I was 12. So my mother, I was basically a person that would be able to cut all kind of stuff and designs and stuff in people's heads. So my mother said to me, she said, son, what are you going to do when people's not wearing that anymore? I said, Mommy, I was going to wear that. She said, no, you see anybody walking around with haircuts from the 50s? I said, no, I guess not. So she said, you may want to start really, you know, focusing on your craft. So I went to a barber college in 97 at Kane's Barber College in Chicago on King Drive Street. Mm-hmm. And I also attended Hair Masters where I got an instructor's degree. And it's just been my life ever since. I've loved it since I picked it up. So here I am.
So when you found out about Books with Barbers, what was your reaction and what made you want to get involved?
I was ecstatic because the kids are the future. If without them, we're in trouble if we don't educate them first. You know, and I've always been a firm believer of each one teach one. So that's always been a motto of mine. I actually mentor to small kids when they come in about gangs and drugs and things of that nature. Because, you know, I grew up from the south side of Chicago, Inglewood, which is part of Chicago public to live in. You know, so I seen a whole lot of it, you know, a lot of friends killed and things of that nature. So, you know, just to be able to bring my children to Bloomington Normal, and we've been here about 20 years, you know, was a big change and a big step. But I'm glad that I made this step because it made my kids some better people.
So barbershops have this really special place in the community. Most people go there to commune and socialize, and it's still an old-fashioned place. How do you feel like you fit into the broader part of the community?
I've been doing this for, like I said, 20-something years. So in Bloomington, I've owned barbershops and things of that nature for years. So, I mean, I just try my best to be a pillar in the community, you know, and help out where need be.
So what's been the best part of the experience so far with these kids?
I would say just being able to educate them. And the books is what really actually helps. You know, you were there at the community day, which was a big, big hit on Saturday. I've done that for the last 10 years with Christ Temple, which is my home church. And then we have an event that we do on Tuesday, which is tomorrow at the Coliseum for the Book Bag Drive. We have also like two or three other events that we do a year. So we do probably about five or six events free of charge where we cut hair. Last year we did nails and hair. So we brought some students out, and they did nails, and then we did the male and female hair.
So kids can be a little fidgety when they're sitting in the chair. Do you believe that this program helps give them a reason to stay still and give you a little bit more time to focus?
Nah, not necessarily, because, I mean, you got to expect that out of kids. You know, they just, you know, you get some that's going to be fidgety and some's going to be okay. You know, you just got to expect that. And me being in this industry for as long as I have, I mean, I just learned little tricks, you know. We got the lollipops, and, you know, the first and main thing I would say is you gotta let them trust you. You know, if they don't trust you, you're going to have a hard time, you know. And mainly, I take my time. So what I do is I start, you know, I may cut the clippers on to let them hold them or just kind of touch their skin with it so, you know, they can get comfortable. Because if not, you're going to be in for a long haircut.
So how do you believe parents have acted towards the program? How do you think their reaction has been when they walk into the shop and, you know, you're saying their kid can read the book to them?
They've responded well. Actually, a lot of them came in with the actual clippings out the paper and was telling me, like, hey, we seen you in the newspaper, or we seen you on the news, or this or that. So I was pretty excited about it. You know, I've never been a part of something so beautiful, you know. you know, and this really is a great thing. I really think the ladies, they've done a magnificent job with this. I take my hat off to them.
Okay, Karen, so for our listeners who don't know, what exactly is the West Bloomington Revitalization Project?
Yeah, we're a group of individuals who focus on the west side of Bloomington, just west of downtown, and we work on building neighborhood and really preserving that historic core of our community. We have a number of initiatives. We have the Tool Library, the Bike Co-op, Veggie Oasis. I run the Book Bike Program. So we're doing a lot of outreach and making sure that we're all communicating and collaborating.
So this isn't the first literacy program that the organization has done. You've all done the Book and Bike Program as well. Why is literacy so important to your organization?
Well, youth in general is one of our focus of our strategic plan. You know, we recognize that, you know, our youth are a vital part of our community. We want to make sure that we're nurturing them and appreciating them and making sure that they have the best education and that they're well connected with the adults around them. So reading is part of that.
So Mary, I found that you said it was a dream that actually prompted the creation of this program. Could you tell us a little bit more about the dream?
I think what really started the dream was actually an NPR piece that was aired in October of 2016 about some barbers in Ypsilanti, Michigan, who are doing basically the same thing. They're having children read to them when they're in their barber chairs to them. And it kept popping up on my feed, and I thought maybe this would be something we could start here. And working with the school district, I know how important literacy is for the students in our district.
So Karen and Mary, what kind of help do you all need from the public to continue the program?
Well, I think at this point we're trying to figure out exactly how we keep the book stock fresh. Once we have a good solid program with our two barbershops, we'll be looking to expand that to barbers and salons, you know, because we know children are getting their hair cut, you know, both genders are getting their hair cut all over Bloomington Normal. You know, we've had some people make some really interesting suggestions to us. One woman was suggesting, for example, that instead of doing celebrity reading to children, that we have children read to our local celebrities. So maybe a child is reading to one of our mayors or the police chief. And, you know, and she went on to share with me that she had come across a little girl who was sitting with the Abraham Lincoln statue in front of the Museum of History and was reading out loud to Abraham Lincoln. You know, what a delightful thing to think about. And you know, the more that we can have children feel comfortable with reading and know that it matters to the people around them that love them, the better. There's a lot of research that tells us that if you're not reading well by the third grade, your chances of really being successful later in your life are diminished. And this is an opportunity to help turn that around and to build that sense of community with the children and the adults in Bloomington Normal.
So you mentioned earlier that the concept is spreading around in different other towns. Where do you all see the program going in the future?
Well, I think we'll be asking people to suggest shops and salons to us. We know as well that we probably need to provide some books in Spanish and French because we have, you know, folks whose families are primarily Spanish-speaking or perhaps from Democratic Republic of the Congo, that kind of thing. So, we've already been asked to bring Spanish books in, which was a very cool thing. And, of course, we have them, and we want to make that happen.
No, we're just so thankful for the barbers that were willing to step up so quickly and be a part of our program, and the enthusiasm of the families and the kiddos reading. I think if they want to be a part of this, they can always donate books to the WBRP for the book bike. We also have books at the barber shops at the door that are from the WBRP book bike that they can take home. So the kids don't even have to stop reading at the barbershop. They can take them home as well.
And I guess we should share with any salons or barbers who might be interested in reaching out to us that part of the grant that we're working with Eric, for example, when he does a haircut, then he makes a notation that he's done, that he's been letting the child read to him and interacting with that child about the book, and then that child gets $2 off of his haircut, and then our grant is reimbursing his barbershop $2. So that makes him whole, you know, just financially, and, you know, and we know when we walk in and we see the kids sitting there that it's a beautiful thing.
Eric, one more question. Where do you see yourself going in the future with the barbershop and the impact with the kids?
Me, like I said, me being in the barber industry for as long as I have, hopefully we could expand and probably get a bigger place maybe, or you know, just being better with the community, hopefully, you know, just doing, you know, helping out in the community. And that's been my main focus is, like I say, each one teach one.
That's Eric Howard from the One of a Kind Barbership in downtown Bloomington, speaking with WGLT student reporter Tiffany Jackson. They were joined in studio by Karen Schmidt and Mary Aunt from the new Barbers with Books program.
For many of us, the sound of summer is an elusive ice cream truck with a herd of kids giving chase. If that's the sound of summer, Morning Edition is the sound of the start of your day. From shocking swimming pool news,
1 in 4 people admitted to peeing in a pool as an adult,
to debates on dessert.
Cup or cone?
Cone.
Sugar or waffle?
Listen every day from NPR News.
I'm GLT Morning Edition host John Norton. Join me weekdays from 4 to 9 a.m. on GLT.
Support for WGLT comes from Normandy Village, hosting Bocce at the Village, where two-person teams compete in a double elimination tournament September 7th. Family-friendly, live music, food, wine, and beer. Team registration at the Normandy Village Facebook page. This is 89.1 WGLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Still to come, an environmental spill in Portage, Indiana has neighbors up in arms. The Bloomington Normal Economic Development Council named Patrick Hoban its new president and CEO in July. 2 weeks now on the job, Hoban speaks with GLT's Mary Cullen about what he has learned about the community so far and where he wants to see progress.
The first couple of weeks, what we've been doing is meeting with some of our key stakeholders on our board. I'm trying to find out what has worked in the past and maybe what some of the challenges are moving forward and making sure that we're all on the same page. Some of those included, you know, meeting with the county, both the administrator and also Coach Mack, who's always been a great resource for some history around here, and then also meeting with the city of Bloomington and the town of Normal officials, just to make sure that they've got their own economic development goals, that we're meeting their needs.
So you mentioned those economic development goals. In its search for a new CEO, the EDC noted a desire to diversify the workforce here in Bloomington Normal. Do you have any ideas yet on how to accomplish or work towards that goal?
Sure. I think a lot of it's going to actually spin off of what's going on with Rivian. I mean, Rivian's a very exciting company, and there's a lot of solid manufacturers that are already here. So trying to bring in more manufacturers, build off the ones that we have, and not necessarily get away from the insurance industry that we have, but we have a lot of white collar jobs here. So trying to get a little bit more of a mix, I think, and diversify, like if you think of a 401k portfolio, same type method is what we're looking to do as well.
So what ideas do you personally bring to the table from your experiences? I know, like you said, there have been ideas already locally that have been brewing, but what do you think should be changed or maybe progress towards?
I would say progress towards, we're going to find that out as we work on our business retention and expansion. That's going to be right off the bat. I need to get somebody in there who's going to actually do what you're doing right now, interviewing the businesses, finding out if they're in growth mode. If not, what are the barriers so we can get them out of the way? If they've got suppliers and buyers, can we move them closer? I'm not really going to bring a whole lot that's new to the economic development industry. We're just going to work off of best practices. I am a certified economic developer from the International Economic Development Council. So these are something that's a worldwide best practices that we're going to implement here. And I'd say one thing that I would bring to the table is some of the new technology that's out there that we're going to mix in with some of the practices that I learned from Notre Dame in business analytics. So it's going to be how we track what we're doing. Like, I don't want anyone in the public or anyone on our board to ever ask, what are you guys working on? Everyone's going to know what industries are interested, what the challenges are, and what we can all do to work together to fix them.
So you mentioned some of this past experience. Before coming to Bloomington Normal, you worked in economic development in Tinley Park, where you were named one of the 40 under 40 economic development managers. And you also worked in your hometown of Decatur before that. So from those experiences, is there anything that you had done in your previous roles that you think would work well here in Bloomington Normal?
Oh, well, it's a combination of all of it. I'm going to go back right to the best practices side of things. When I was in Decatur, over a decade, we've actually had over $1 billion worth of investment. So it's a combination of Caterpillar's retrofit to their plant, but also the $250 million ADM intermodal yard. So it's working with the state. It's working with our local elected officials, bringing everyone to the table and really meeting the needs of the businesses that are here. And that's what we can use to sell their success stories to new businesses to bring in. Same thing in Tinley Park. It's a different animal. It was a village. But it's a bedroom community. So everyone lived in Tinley Park, but work in Chicago. So it was more about bringing in hotels, breweries, distilleries, you know, all the fun quality of life things, which is something right now I don't believe that our EDC focuses on. But as we start getting into more of a battle for workforce, quality of life is a must. And so it's something that I know that the college students look at when they're coming to Bloomington Normal. They're looking to see, you know, what's going to be there. But it's the same thing with the trailing spouse or anyone as you're attracting talent. I mean, there's some people that won't come down here unless there's a Trader Joe's. So, I mean, everyone's looking for certain perks in certain companies. And if they're not here, we're not going to get them. So it's really us against Chicago right now. So mixing in some of that to bring that down here, I think, will help.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mary Cullen speaking with Patrick Hoban, the new president and CEO of the Bloomington Normal Economic Development Council. The city of Bloomington earlier this year decided to operate its very own economic development department. How do you see that department fitting into your mission?
They're definitely a part of what we do. So my past experience when I was in Decatur for 7 years, I worked for the EDC, and then I switched over to the city's economic development department. One is more focused on just city retail side of things, where we're non-retail right now, but that's where it was really important for us to meet with the town of Normal and the city of Bloomington to see what their mission was and how we can complement each other. Because right now we're a three-person office, and so the more people we can get involved, the better off we're going to be.
So the Bloomington Normal Economic Development Council previously compiled a wish list for federal funds, including a Downtown Connect Transit Transfer Center, a pedestrian underpass in Normal, marketing for Route 66, and a small business incubator in Normal. So how do you see those projects fitting into your goals?
So that's all going to be part of our, I believe, One Voice campaign that will be taken to the federal level to see if there's funding with that. Every single goal that we have, any project that comes through, is going to be based off of ROI. And I don't want to be that number specific, but I'd say the bigger the ROI, the more effort we're going to put towards it. And if it's something that Normal wants, it's something that Bloomington wants, we're more than happy to be those cheerleaders, offer support and the analytics to support those projects. But at the end of the day, it has to make financial sense.
Big picture thinking, a year from now, what would you like to see have changed? Where would you like to see the Bloomington Economic Development Council having made progress?
I would say right off the bat, it's just this is a game of information and relationships. So I want to know everybody that can bring something to the table. I want to have relationships with every developer in town. I already have relationships with developers out of Chicago, so I want to be bringing them down for familiarization tours. When they get here, I want the public to know, hey, we've got somebody important in town, you know, put on your best face, and we're all going to sell this thing together. So I think what I like to see going forward is just that I have a relationship with our local developers, the landowners, and the businesses, and find out what they need and start getting some projects on the books, because they brought me in to do deals.
GLT's Mary Cullen speaking with Patrick Hoban, the new president and CEO of the Bloomington Normal Economic Development Council. Hoban replaces former BNEDC CEO Kyle Hamm, who left more than a year ago. Vice President Mike O'Grady served as interim CEO until his retirement this summer. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Coming up, a late blooming, late summer edition of GLT's Grow. The beachfront city of Portage, Indiana, is reeling from a chemical spill. Portage is less than an hour east of Chicago. A steel plant dumped excess cyanide and ammonia into a river that leads into Lake Michigan. Thousands of fish died. Portage's summer recreation industry is hurting from a ban on swimming and fishing. The spill was bad enough, but area residents are angry it took so long to learn about it. IPR's Michael Puente has more.
On most summer days, you can find Dana Bourne on his boat he calls Just Chillin'. He keeps the boat at the marina in Portage and often takes it into Lake Michigan to fish or swim, but not this past week.
Can't fish, obviously, because they're all dead. And then mostly we go out to the beach and swim, which I can't do right now either. So we used to be able to nice take the corner around here and just swim and come right back in, no big deal. Now I got to get like all the way down to Michigan City almost before it's safe.
Bourne wonders why it took so long for the public to be notified.
They didn't really report to us about, you know, what happened till way later, which was kind of disgusting. You know, there was people in the beach up in, you know, in those days that they were still swimming in those chemicals, and no one even said anything about it.
Here's the timeline of what happened. On August 11th, the ArcelorMittal steel plant began spilling more ammonium and cyanide than its permit allows. On August 12th, a citizen found a dead fish in a river that ultimately leads to the lake. The person called the Indiana Department of Environmental Management and another state agency. But those agencies didn't notify the public. 2 days later, thousands more dead fish were found. Finally, 3 days after the steel plant knew of the toxic leak, word got to the city of Portage.
The facts are we should have been informed as soon as that spill occurred Sunday night, Monday. And we were not.
This is Portage Mayor John Cannon.
We were not informed by ARCEL, and we were not informed by IDEM or DNR. No one contacted our office.
The steel plant is not supposed to spill excess toxic waste into the river that leads to Lake Michigan, but when it does...
Under their permit, they have a 24-hour window to report to the Indiana Department of Environmental Management when they find themselves non-compliant. That's a pretty big window.
Natalie Johnson directs Save the Dunes Council, a nonprofit environmental group. She wants to know why regulators kept the public in the dark.
An organization that is meant to safeguard the public's health and the health of the environment, we would want to see being more proactive and really alerting everyone that something isn't right. We didn't see that happen.
Communication about toxic spills along the lakefront are not always this low. Portage Mayor John Cannon says U.S. Steel Company immediately contacted his office this week when an oily substance was found in a local waterway.
But that's how it's supposed to work. That's the protocol that has happened since the chromium spills from U.S. Steel.
He's talking about a chromium spill in 2017. U.S. Steel ultimately made a legal agreement with Portage to communicate better. Mayor Cannon says ArcelorMittal could face fines for notifying the public so late, and that's on top of any fines for the spills. Neither ArcelorMittal or IDEM would provide comment on the time it took to notify the public about last week's toxic discharges. For affected boaters like Dana Bourne, a fine paid out by ArcelorMittal will mean little.
I feel like the steel mills have more money. They don't care so much. I mean, they're willing to pay the fine because it's way cheaper to pay the fine than actually just do what's supposed to be done. Well, you got a lot of billionaires just throwing money out like it's nothing.
I'm Michael Puente.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. There's nothing wrong with being a late bloomer. In fact, that's exactly what you might want in late summer for your yard and landscaping. In this edition of our gardening podcast, Grow, ISU's Patrick Murphy shares some plans to add some color to your garden and landscape.
As summer begins to wind down, so does the landscaping, but it doesn't have to be that way. There are late season bloomers to help keep some color in your yard. This is GLT's Grow, your podcast source for practical gardening advice from our expert Patrick Murphy from Illinois State University School of Biological Sciences, and he's curator of the Fell Arboretum. I'm Mike McCurdy. Thanks for stopping by for another edition of Grow.
Thank you for having me, Mike.
It's amazing, after all of the rain this spring, how dry it is right now in parts of the Midwest. What are some plants to consider planting that can give some interest to the landscaping at this late summer point? And should we start with hydrangeas?
Why not? Everybody loves hydrangeas. They're recognizable. The flowers are quite recognizable. Now, the hydrangeas that you and I are talking about, Mike, are a little bit different than the ones that we see as garden fare. They're more fleshy. The hydrangeas that I want everyone to consider are a woodier type of hydrangea. My favorite is the tardiva hydrangeas, along with some of the other panicle hydrangeas. They produce fantastic late season blooms, large bloom. So they show up at greater distances than a lot of other flowers do. And for the tardiva and the straight species panicle hydrangea, these blooms can last for a month or more. So that's something we encounter with the hot season blooming shrubs. Sometimes they only bloom for a week or two. And when it's been brutally hot and sunny and very little wind, you know, it's just makes those summer flowers even shorter. So you really starve for flowers when you get this far along.
Are these white or creamy colored blooms?
They are whitish pinky to creamish yellow. So you can kind of weave them into your palette easily, because that's a kind of complementary color. White goes with everything, as they say. And with the flowers lasting for more than a month, there's also great potential for cut flowers from these plants.
What do you think of white flowers? I like them at dusk and in the evening hours. They seem to glow.
I find that appealing as well. I find that white flowers are great because they kind of they reflect the light of the other colors that are there. So in that regard, they can bring colors together. And they're formal also.
And with these hydrangea, is it possible changing the pH level in the soil to change the color of the blooms like you can with other hydrangea?
I think that's for our garden fair hydrangeas, like our garden macrophylla, the endless summer, all those that have the kind of the softball-shaped bloom. Mm-hmm. Those are the ones that people manipulate to get the violet colors.
And the ones you're talking about have more conical blooms?
It's more conical, kind of like a big ice cream cone shape. Yeah.
So hydrangea has hydra right in its name. How much water is needed to keep these plants happy in the late dry days of summer?
The ones that we're talking about are what I would consider typical fare. They're going to require the same watering that any shrub would require. A little more when they're planted, a little less as the weather starts to help out as you go along. Their counterparts that are the spring bloomers that we love around Mother's Day, they require a lot of water. And a lot of times when we experience the heat and humidity that we've had so far this season, no flowers, just vegetative growth.
So any other hydrangea varieties to consider?
Yes, Mike. There's one that's called the PG hydrangea, and I like to mention this one because it on its own will grow in a tree form. It's confused for a small ornamental tree because it has that habit. It has the traditional shaped flower that we know from the tropical hydrangeas and the macrophylla, so it's kind of that softball shape. But these flowers are a little smaller. And they come in the whites to violets. Hmm. So this is a hydrangea that can give you the white to violet blooms without having to add the extra step of trying to manipulate the soil pH.
When I think of a dry prairie, I think of sage. What about sage in the garden? Does that work and add some color in the late season?
Sage is good. And also for a point you already mentioned, it's a drought-tolerant plant that can handle really poor soils. It can handle soils that get very hot. So if it's like a parking island or a curbed planting.
Or if you're mulching with rock.
Yeah, or if you've got a rock base. But the sage is kind of is grassy in appearance, and it smells nice when mm-hmm. it's wet. So if it's in an irrigated spot or where it has a little morning dew on it.
Or if you brush up against it.
Or if you get it all over your gear, that's right. And the sage is great for all of the life cycle characters that we share this world with. Yeah. Bees, butterflies, birds, they all love it.
I don't know if you mentioned it, but purplish flowers.
Purplish flower, kind of a vertical spiky type thing.
So what about, so sage, salvia, are they related? Salvia is something different?
That's different.
Okay. So when I think of sage, but I also think of lavender, I know they're different plants, but they're often sort of used interchangeably in the garden or in the landscaping.
There's some similarities, definitely some similarities. The sage is a bigger plant than lavender here in the Midwest. It's basically an annual. I know there are lots of listeners that live here in the Midwest that have had lavender reappear in their garden for many seasons, but they are fortunate and of the exception. Most of the times, lavender is not hardy, and it just doesn't survive the winter here. But it has some of those same kind of medicinal and homey benefits as sage. It smells nice. You can steep it and make your house smell nice. You can add it to meat or other vegetable blends and things like that.
Any specific varieties?
I don't have any specific varieties of lavender. I know that Munstead lavender is one that we're fond of because it's supposed to be more tolerant of cold. Now, there's Mona lavender, and it's not a true lavender. It is a leafy plant that has kind of a burgundy-colored leaf and has a very noticeable, long-lasting, fragrant purple flower. And it's born on a spike, so it's up above the rest of the foliage. Mona lavender and lavender that is growing on the hillsides in California, or they're not even related. The Mona lavender, I believe lavender is in the common name because of the color of the bloom.
We talked about hydrangea, which are shrubby. What about some other flowering shrubs for some Midwest late summer color?
One of my favorites, Mike, is bluebeard or bluebeard shrub. Caryopteris clandonensis is the genus and species that we're looking for here. This is a massing type of perennial that has some strength. So it's a little bit on the woody side, close to the ground, like the sage we've already talked about. This is a plant that gives you blue blooms. I'm somebody that loves blue. I wear it almost every day. It's just easy to not think about
it. So a lot of times in gardening, though, blue is actually purple. Are we talking blue or are we talking purple?
I'm talking blue, closer to the blue side of the spectrum, not so much purple like in violet. That's one of the reasons that I think the bluebeard is nice. Also, it's underutilized. It's a very tough, reliable plant. It masses itself kind of like regular lavender or Russian sage. It's controllable. And you could get away with not cutting it back for a number of years if you had it standing in a remote planting bed and not have to worry about it.
What about another plant, another shrub?
Vanilla spice or summer sweet is a regional common name for a fantastic plant. This produces a white kind of thin foxtail type bloom. There are several different cultivars right here at the Fell Arboretum that one could come and see. This is a plant that appears in landscapes a lot of times planted in mass. If you look at the football field, Illinois State's Redbird Arena, near the entrance planting beds, there are large colonies of this plant.
And does it smell like vanilla?
It has a great, pleasant, subtle fragrance, not over-the-top, sticky sweet. And low-maintenance shrub, gorgeous, fragrant flowers that bloom in the summer for up to a month. And they give the hummingbirds something to dine on before they fly away. And it's also been known to deter deer.
If you have any questions about late season bloomers or anything in the garden or landscape, get in touch and we might answer them on an upcoming episode of Grow. I'm Mike McCurdy with Patrick Murphy. Send your gardening questions to wglt.org/grow.
This has been Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal.